Good afternoon, everybody. To our listeners, welcome back to another episode of the Chantillon Group's podcast, Relentless Pursuit. Today, we're back to our special series focusing on defining wealth management for the next generation. My name is Charlie DeLay. For those of you who don't know me, I'm a senior private wealth strategy associate with UBS Private Wealth Management. And most of my time working with the Chantillon Group focuses on working with our second and third generation clients and beyond. For a lot of the families the teams work with, they're in a fortunate position to transition the wealth they've accumulated to subsequent generations. So on today's call, we will be discussing concepts behind this transition. What are the components of a basic estate plan? What are they designed to do? How can I think about this at the various stages of my financial life? So to help answer these questions, we'd like to bring on a special guest, Terry Larson, who is a wealth strategist with UBS's advanced planning team. And she's going to take us through wealth transfer and estate planning and all those aspects I just outlined. Carrie, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm sure my intro did not do you justice. So please tell us a little bit more about yourself and what your role here is at UBS.
Sure. So I am an attorney in the state of New York, and I am also a certified financial planner. I've been with UBS about 4 years in the Advanced Planning Group, which is a special group of attorneys that sit across the country. And our main goal is to service teams and clients like yours in all things estate planning. So while you guys can talk about investments and portfolios and how the money will be invested, we tend to focus on where the money will be invested in terms of who and what cut does Uncle Sam get, and if the clients are comfortable with that, or do they have different goals in mind for their sort of dynastic wealth and transitioning the wealth that they've accumulated to their children and future generations.
The title of today's podcast we came up with is Estate Planning, It's Not Like the Movies.
Yes.
So I think oftentimes everyone's first exposure to a trust or a will is in some movie or novel that they're reading. And there's so many wacky examples there of a kid inheriting a business or a large sprawling mansion or even a sports team, and some of my favorite ones, in front of a crowded room of onlookers. So how does that actually work?
Yes, well, I mean, in all things movies, there's a artistic license, and the directors don't tend to go to law school and study estate planning. So what we see, it tends to make the inheritances to these wacky and kooky beneficiaries as a surprise. So not only do they inherit the sports team or the mansion, but they always seem to be surprised at this fact, or that they're not necessarily the ideal beneficiaries of this gift. And it makes the planning look almost antiquated or old, which estate planning and good estate planning is anything but. When you have a good estate plan, it's not set in mortar and there for life. It's a plan that conforms to different stages in your life, different life events like marriages or children, grandchildren, divorces, and ever-changing laws, both in the tax world and in the estate planning world. So good plans, good documents, we call them living documents, as they should go through many changes throughout one's life to be able to adapt. And unlike the movies, if your wacky nephew isn't the beneficiary of your choice, that should have been or will be addressed in a good estate plan. Further, there are ways to document your estate plan so that there isn't a large room or a huge form that's reading out your estate plan wishes. It's very much a possibility to make that private.
So let's start from the ground up, right? I think
sure.
Most people have heard of a will, but what are the other core documents that most families typically have in place in any basic estate plan?
Sure. So we tend to break up the estate planning into two phases. So phase one, as mentioned, is planning with core documents. And these are documents everyone should have, not based on wealth, I should say, and have them in place no matter what. Phase two in the estate planning world is more geared towards maximizing your gifts to future generations, less tax, more assets, and using certain exemptions and tricks, I guess I should say, that the government allows you to make within that plan. So within the phase one, the basic estate plan, we would break that up further into documents that you need upon an incapacitation and documents that you need at death. And they are mutually exclusive. So the documents that you put in place for incapacitation cease to govern the moment you die. Also, if you come out of incapacitation, then they will also cease to be active. The two most important documents for incapacitation would be what we call a healthcare proxy, which is accompanied by a living will. Sometimes they're the same document, sometimes they're different. And what that does is it designates a person that you wish to relay your healthcare wishes to a physician upon an incapacitation, or if you're unable to do so yourself. So you would outline in this document your certain health wishes, like being intubated, receiving artificial nutrition, hydration, being put on a ventilator, but basically whether you want to stay plugged in or not plugged in. It's very
not fun topics to contemplate.
No, it
but
is
certainly
certain, but it's important. And this document outlines those wishes and designate sort of a mouthpiece to be able to communicate those wishes to a physician. The durable power of attorney is a similar document used in incapacitation, but instead of your health matters, you would designate an individual for financial matters. So this would be accessing your bank accounts to pay healthcare bills or your mortgage, allowing that individual to enter into certain types of agreements, like if your house needs to be sold in order to pay your mortgage and that sort of thing during incapacitation.
Now, do both those parties have to be the same person?
No, they do not. And sometimes even parents will say, well, I have one whiz kid who's great with money, but in a second would unplug me if they could. So they would designate maybe one child to do the healthcare proxy and the other child in the durable power of attorney. Could very well be the same person. Another important thing to mention about these documents, while it might be assumed, oh, I'm married or I'm at college and my parents would do that, it's not that cut and dry. So while it could be your parents or your spouse that would be chosen to be your representative, they would need to be court appointed if you don't have these documents in place.
So if I'm going to school across the country or I take that first job and I'm states away, something to think about.
Yes, absolutely. And it could happen to anyone, right? So these documents are important to have in place for anyone over the age of 18. The second set of core documents within the phase one planning are the documents that kick in at death. So this would be most commonly known, the will, and what we like to call a revocable trust. Now, a will for ultra high net worth or high net worth individuals, a lot of times they put focus on anonymity. So as mentioned about our movie scenario, wills are public documents. Once the person passes away and the will is submitted to probate or court to settle your estate, is what probate is, that will become public information. So if you go online, you can Google wills for Marilyn Monroe, Jackie O, and the like. If you want to keep that information private and have it not be made public, you would do something called a pour-over will situation, where basically all your will it does is name the executors to your estate and to direct any assets that aren't already owned in a revocable living trust to that revocable living trust. So a revocable living trust is a document that, unlike any of these other documents we talked about, it's valid during life, during incapacitation, and at death. So during life, it acts just as a normal bank account that's not a gift to a trust. Basically, it has your social security number and you can take assets out and deposit assets in as freely as you like. During incapacitation, it'll name a trustee and have certain provisions that will allow for the payment of your bills, similar to the durable power of attorney. And then at death, it acts exactly like a will. So those provisions that you would normally think would be in a will, I would like my wife to get X dollars and I'd like my home to pass to my daughter, that sort of thing. Those are all taken care of in the revocable trust, which is a private document. So it's
so not as exciting as the movies.
No. not quite. And if it's a good revocable trust, it'll be updated frequently so that less desirable beneficiaries like the kooky nephew won't inherit all.
Understood. So it seems everybody, you said 18, but everybody should have some of these in some way, shape, or form. So is 18 the age? Are there other kind of life events or pivoting points that increase the urgency where somebody should consider getting the will or revocable trust either updated or doing it for the first time?
That's a great question. And yes, so as mentioned, the healthcare proxy and power of attorney, they should be for any individual over the age of 18. Those individuals should have them. The good news is that each state has their own sort of form or template that they like to use that is in compliance with that specific state law around medical information and the like. And those forms are easily downloadable from the interwebs, if you will. Further, with COVID, not only are these documents now more important to have, but even if you have them, it's important to review them because sometimes there will be do not put me on a respirator sort of desires. And with COVID, being on a respirator doesn't mean it's end of life sort of action. You very well could come out of the respirator. So it's important to review the terms that are already in your documents if you have them. But if not, or if you don't have them, they're easily obtainable at low or no cost. And additionally, a lot of states are allowing for remote notarization. You know, over Zoom or video, you can have documents notarized so you don't have to go into a law firm.
Really? Wow.
Yes. For anyone, I would recommend at least the healthcare proxy and durable power of attorney. For the documents that sort of kick in at death, definitely if you have children, or small children under the age of 18.
The first child or the marriage, yes, something like that.
Because this would name the guardians for your children. However, a lot of states have something called intestate laws, which are laws that will govern the distribution of your assets if you do not have a will in place. So New York is sort of unique, where if you had a wife and a small child, the first $50,000 of your estate would pass to your spouse, and the remaining assets would be split 50-50 between your spouse and your child, which the child would then have full access to, I believe, at age 21. So a lot of times people assume that because they're married, all
now
of
that sounds like a movie with an unintended surprise.
Exactly. Most people assume that because they're married, all of their assets will go to their spouse if they don't have a will, which in some states is true. New York is not one of those states. Also, if you are single, your assets typically would pass to your parents. Or if you don't have either parent alive, but you have siblings, your assets would pass to your siblings, which a lot of people, myself included, would not. I would rather give it to anyone else than my brother. So it's important to also make sure that if you really are against getting a will, that you review the intestate provisions in the state that you reside in. And if you're okay with who would get your property and the amount, then great. But if not, then it would be important to at least make a will.
Such helpful information. And I think kind of at the top of our discussion, you said there's kind of phase one and phase two. And with respect to your time here today, I think that gave our listeners enough to contemplate on the phase one planning. But what about this mysterious phase two? I think some people, especially back to our movie example, like I'll just throw a a wacky number out there. Why can't I just give $1 billion all to my kids? You said something about Uncle Sam coming in. There is some taxation that goes on. And how does that work from just a kind of brief overview standpoint, if some of our listeners say have never had any exposure to that and were unaware that you can't just pass as much money as you'd like to your kid?
Yes, exactly. So phase one, the core document. Phase two becomes more applicable in families and individuals that have wealth that exceed this threshold that the federal government puts in place for taxation of estates. So you certainly could give your children $1 billion, but that $1 billion would be taxed. And right now, it's the highest exemption amount it's ever been at $11,580,000. So what this means is that the federal government says every person out there can gift this $11.5 million either during life or through their estate at death. And this number, you know, obviously mentions it's the highest it's ever been, creates very, very small percentage of people who will actually pay an estate tax when they die under this amount of exemption. However, for the people that do die and they have more than this exemption amount, that's subject to 40% tax at the federal level, which doesn't include any tax that your state may or may not apply. So for instance, in New York, the highest percentage of tax is 16%. So with 40% federal and 16% New York, blended rate comes in around 51%. So without careful planning, that $1 billion would become $500 million very, very quickly. There are ways that you can transfer assets to future generations without using your $11.58 million. Or if you've exhausted it, you can transfer these assets without paying an additional gift tax during your life. Some strategies, and attorneys love acronyms, so we sometimes call it the alphabet soup of strategies just because it's a whole onslaught of acronyms. But the first popular planning strategy we call is a grantor retained annuity trust, or a GRAT. And simply speaking, it's a trust that lasts 3 to 5 years where you would put assets in, let's call it $1 million of Apple stock each year of the term. So if it was 2 years term, you would get back a proportionate share of the principal. So the first year you would get back $500,000. And at the end of the second year, or the end of the grant term, you would get back that other $500,000 plus a certain percentage rate. So the government right now is at 0.4% for something called the 75-20 rate, which means that 1 million of Apple shares, anything above that 0.4%, you are able to transfer to beneficiaries at the end of that 2 year term without using additional gift tax. So
you've essentially created a freebie that doesn't apply to that gift or estate tax. Are there any other, I hate to use the term freebie, but are there any other things that you're allowed to do kind of outright if it's a noble pursuit? Like, I think you can pay for education. I don't know if there's any others.
Yes. So the government says that you are able to pay education or healthcare expenses without limits and without it being considered a gift, so long as you pay those assets directly to the educational institution or the healthcare provider, which also could include healthcare insurance. So if you're paying healthcare insurance on behalf of an individual, just make sure you write that check to Cigna or whomever and not to that individual to then pay their insurance through. So these are the two sort of freebies that the government allows, and that is for anybody. You could do it for family members, friends, strangers, as long as it's paid directly to the institution. Above and beyond that, kind of a more applicable among the masses would be something called an annual exclusion. and that would allow individuals to gift $15,000 a year to any person. So I can gift $15,000 a year to my best friend, my dad, and my cousin. If I'm married, I can gift $30,000 to my best friend, my dad, and my cousin. And then that does not count towards that $11.5 million you have to gift during your life. And then next year, I can gift the same $30,000 to those three recipients.
So each year that resets.
Yep, each year that resets. And a lot of times our clients most commonly will use this for 529 plans to fund those each year for their children or grandchildren, or use it as an insurance annual premium if they decide to have a trust that owns an insurance policy on their life.
And I think there we're getting into the crack that you just talked about, kind of the tip of the iceberg of phase two and all that goes on. Just listening to you here today, it's clearly you're passionate about this. And one of the things you're trying to do on this series as well is, if any of our listeners are out there not only trying to get some knowledge about a particular topic, but they also might be interested in the field. So what drew you and that passion that you have now into estate planning?
A great question. I actually went to law school to pursue family law. I started working at a family office, which allowed me to utilize my passion for numbers and accounting and tax, which is very nerdy, but also married in that sort of family law, pun intended, by dealing with families, the more personal side of law, and using interests and goals, both financial and broadly speaking of families, and meld it with law to get to that sort of goal and point where it minimizes taxes, maximizes assets to future generations, and you can use sort of the tips and tricks of the trade to make sure both of those, minimizing taxes and maximizing assets, are accomplished.
I couldn't have said it better. I know our teams work when we work with your team and with our clients, trust and estates lawyers externally, the puzzle of marrying the tax planning, but also moving the value system and transitioning what created the wealth in a structure that works is always fascinating to me as well. You know, hopefully we can have you back on a future call and kind of dive into more of some of that phase two stuff and go down a couple of rabbit holes and get a couple more of these interesting strategies that you alluded to. But again, with respect to your time, I think we're going to have to sign off here. Unfortunately, as you said, it gets a little nerdy. I'm sure the two of us could talk for about 2 to 3 hours and not even break a sweat. But I think this was a very thorough introduction. And as always, we appreciate your assistance with everything that our team does.
Of course. Happy to help.
Well, with that, everyone, I think we will call it a day today. Please look back for our next podcast coming in our series here about the next generation and defining wealth management on the Relentless Pursuit podcast. Also, please refer to our website, which is in the link below, for all of our prior episodes and everything timely that's coming in the next few weeks here. Thanks again, and have a great day.